What I thought was a stunning announcement, President Donald Trump commuted the federal sentence of Larry Hoover. He was a Chicago gangster disciple gang leader who has been serving six life sentences at the Supermax in Florence, Colorado. It's where they house the people who are extremely high risk. The charges were murder, extortion, money laundering, among other things. And with us to discuss who Larry Hoover was and what role he played in gang activities is Dr. Lance Williams. He's a professor of urban community studies at the Jacob Carruthers Center for Inner City Studies at Northeastern Illinois University. For over 20 years, he's worked as an expert witness. He's spoken and written about gangs and all of these issues relating to gangs. He's the author of Culture and Perceptions of Violence, Related Behaviors Among Adolescents. And he's also the co-author of a book entitled The Almighty Black Peace Donation, The Fall, Rise, and Resurgence of an American Gang. Welcome to the show. Welcome back to the show, Dr. Williams. How are you today?
I'm just fine. Thanks so much for having me, Karen.
So tell me what your first thought was when you heard about the commutation of Larry Hoover.
My first thought was that things are about to get very interesting in Chicago.
And what are you basing that on?
Well, I wasn't surprised. There had been some chatter throughout, the city about the possibility of Mr. Hoover being or having his sentence commuted. This is something, a conversation that has been going on actually since the first Trump administration when Kanye West and his wife Kim, along with several other people, lobbied the president for the release of Mr. Hoover. So this has been going on for a few years or so. But hearing it now and actually learning of his sentence being commuted, it just, for those of us that work in this particular field, just understand that this is about to be a very interesting time in the city.
Let's do a little history lesson here. You have studied the gangs, and you have grown up. I believe your father was a gang member. Is that fair to say?
Yeah, that's true. You've had
an interest historically in the gangs in Chicago. You're very knowledgeable about it. Can you tell us about who Larry Hoover is, and what? And tell us a little bit about the gangster disciples.
Okay, so yes, very interestingly, he has a very interesting background. So Mr. Hoover actually as a child, his family migrated to Chicago from Mississippi along the time of what we would consider the second migration. So there was a period of time in the late 40s, early 50s, where a lot of African Americans were beginning to migrate from rural areas in the South to the city. But in his particular case, his family relocated to the area around 69th and Halsted in Englewood. And I think this particular area had a major impact on his life because the house that he lived in was right next door to the parking lot of a club, a night lounge called the Guys and Gals Lounge, which was at the time the most popular nightclub lounge on the south side of Chicago. So as a little boy, he was exposed to that nightlife. All he needed to do was look out of his window or come out of his house, and he would see all sorts of things, a lot of prostitution in the area. He was exposed to that, drug dealing and violence and just street hustling. So I think that impacted his life to a great deal as a young boy. And then as a teen, because he was in that environment, he kind of got swept up in the street life. But he was known as a kid who was very stylish. He wasn't the typical, gang-banging kid who was involved in a lot of fights. He was a stylish, very street-savvy kid. Eventually formed a group of young men who kind of gravitated towards his charisma and style, and they formed a group called the Supreme Gangsters. And because they were so popular among teens at that time, the older gangs, guys who were a little older and more established gangs, were attempted to recruit him to their gang because he was a part of a popular youth group. And he resisted these kind of threats and intimidation, and it led to him being shot, you know, multiple times as a teenager, just trying to resist the recruitment. Eventually, he's swept up in it. He agrees to join one group, the Black Disciples, to bring his group in, merge it. So the Supreme Gangsters joined with the Black Disciples. They became the Black Gangster Disciple Nation. And then in 73, Mr. Hoover was, along with another young man, accused of the murder of another 19-year-old who evidently stole drugs from them. And that's where he received that 150 to 200-year sentence that he was serving at the time he got the Fed case in 95. And that's what led to his federal custody.
So let's go back. I want to just talk a little bit about the Gangster Disciples at the time Larry Hoover was operating it. And I know, I guess we should skip ahead a little bit, because when Hoover was in prison in Illinois for that long sentence, he was actually operating the gang from the prison. Is that right?
That's correct. And the Gangster Disciples as an organization, though, remember, were not a thing until his incarceration in the Illinois Department of Corrections.
Okay, so he brought it to their heyday by operating it while he was in prison. And I should know the answer to this, but I don't. I know that at some point he was taken out of, like, Stateville or wherever he was serving, maybe it was Pontiac, and he was put into either a medium or a minimum security prison, and maybe that's why he was able to do it. But is there some explanation as to how he was operating this massive business of gang activity while he was in prison?
Karen, that is an excellent question, and I think that if more people ask that question, it would really explain, you know, what actually happened and what led to him being able to do what he did. So what actually happened in the Illinois Department of Corrections in the early 70s when he was incarcerated, this was a particular time when we saw a mass incarceration period in the state of Illinois. So you have droves of young men coming from Chicago populating prisons around the Illinois Department of Corrections. And the way the prison administration dealt with that, because it was a massive task, they used a system called the Varn Boss system. And what they would do in order to try to control the inmates due to overcrowding, they would allow leaders of the gangs to basically be de facto wardens of whatever prison they were in. So these gang leaders and gang chiefs were allowed to control things like cell assignments, commissary, visitation rooms. And so they were able to use this control that they had in the jails to then influence what was happening outside of the jail. So ultimately, it really was the state that was complicit in bringing about this kind of massive gang breeding environment. And then, in addition to that, there was also rampant corruption inside of the Illinois Department of Corrections, where you had guards and wardens who were kind of facilitating the criminal aspect of this, allowing, you know, gang leaders to communicate with people on the outside, have visitations. And then they also were smuggling drugs in and out of these prisons. And that just turned into a big mess that ultimately led to this thing that we call the Gangster Disciples and some of the other large street gangs that were able to turn into super gangs, so to speak.
We have just a couple minutes before we have to break, but can you tell our listeners a little bit about the magnitude of the Gangster Disciples? I mean, I have read that there were 35 states where there were Gangster Disciples. Do we know the numbers, and do we know the dollar amounts of drugs that were being trafficked?
Yeah, I don't think, you know, technically, I don't think I know law enforcement tends to, unfortunately, exaggerate the numbers. Of course, you know, gang members don't take a census, but they were the largest African-American street gang. So they did have a lot of influence, a lot of control on the streets. But in terms of 30,000, I doubt that very seriously. And then I also doubt very seriously that they were generating $100 million a year in drug sales. I don't think that that's realistic.
Well, we have literally 30 seconds, but my caller said, please ask your guests what the Gangster Disciples pyramid signifies. Is it some kind of structural hierarchy symbol? Do you know the answer to that question?
Yeah, well, the Gangster Disciples don't. He's confusing the Black Peace Stone Nation.
Oh, yes, that was
symbol of the pyramid with the Gangster Disciples.
Okay, yeah. Got it. We are talking to Dr. Lance Williams. We are talking about the commutation of the sentence of Larry Hoover. And when we come back, I want to talk a little bit about what this means in the gang world and how the gang world has changed. We've talked about this on the show before, about how the gang situation was very different back at this time than it is now. Is it better? Is it worse? And what's being done to combat the drugs and the gang activity here in Chicago? Dr. Williams, you are very involved in the gang, trying to help out our youth and teaching about this. And historically, you have a lot of background in this commutation of Larry Hoover. Let's start with the arguments for the commutation and the arguments against it, because I don't want to get political here, but I know that you must have an opinion, and I just want to hear if there are some arguments on both sides of this.
Oh, absolutely. So I think there are three essential arguments against. One is that because of Mr. Hoover's role in drug selling having such a negative impact on a community, that he shouldn't be released. I think a second concern would be that he remains the inspirational leader of the GDEs. And then last, I think people are concerned that just, you know, his release would undermine the respect for law. But on the flip side of that, people would say, well, okay, yes, he's admitted to his involvement in selling drugs. But I think people would say that it's an overstatement to blame all of the problems in African-American community, particularly poor communities, with drug selling and that type of thing. I think that in terms of him being the leader, people would argue that, yes, he is the inspirational leader, but he has denounced his involvement as a leadership. And then those who really follow him as a leader, or who would see him as a leader, tend to be much older individuals in their 50s and 60s and 70s like him, who are nostalgic about the old days, but are not involved in any crime on a day-to-day basis in the streets. The biggest concern is that he would be the leader for the young guys that are active in the streets today. And I can tell you from working with them on a daily basis, that absolutely should not be a concern, because they don't see Larry Hoover or anyone in a leadership capacity as their leader. They, as a matter of fact, today's guys have a disdain. I'm talking about guys that are active in street life or gang affiliated. They have a disdain for leadership. They don't want to have anything to do, and they heavily denounce anyone who proclaims to be their leader. So I don't think that would be a concern. And then last but not least, you hear a lot of conversation in the music and pop culture, rap music, that kind of glorifies street gang life and the GDs. But those are rappers who just rap about it in order to get clout or recognition for something that's popular. So I don't think it should be a big concern, because, you know, the gangs are not structured the way they used to be back in the 70s and 80s. And they're so fractured today, no one individual can come and command anything in the streets today.
Can you talk a little bit about that issue of the splintering of the gangs? Like, you know, back, you know, the Gangster Disciples were a big gang. There were Black Keystone Nation. But now you're talking about, first of all, why are the gangs so splintered and how are they structured?
Yeah, so that's a really good question. So what happened in the late 80s, beginning in the late 80s, starting with the Black Keystone Nation, the feds, FBI, DEA, DEA, ATF, they targeted these organizations and took out all of the top leadership from the Jeff Forts, Larry Hoovers, Marvell Thompsons of the Black Disciples. All of those guys, all of those big organizations were taken out, right? And their leadership has been off the streets for over 30 years. As a matter of fact, that 95 conviction that Mr. Hoover received was a part of one of those big takedowns. And so for the last 35 years or so, the structure of the hierarchy gang and hierarchical organized Black street gangs has not existed. And what that caused was the fragmenting of these groups into these factions that basically are leaderless cliques in neighborhoods that now are into it and fight each other over, you know, interpersonal beef and conflict. So the gang structure today does not exist in a way that it did in the past. In the past, it was vertically organized. Now it's horizontally disorganized.
And which is better?
Well, neither is good, but today is worse. Because at least back in the day, during the time of a Mr. Hoover, you had interest. And the interest was to make money. And you can't make money when it's a lot of violence. And so because you had organized leadership, it could command the discipline and in a way that it could be controlled. Today, there's nothing. It's just the no man's land, and it's completely. And this is the reason that we see so much violence today. Even though the numbers, violence overall has gone down in the city, that's overall in the city. But in the neighborhoods where gangs are the most prevalent, the numbers are higher, much higher than they used to be back in the days.
Interesting. So these, you know, we just had a report that in the first quarter, crime is down, violent crime is down. I think robberies and those types of things may be up. But you're saying that it's just now more focused and concentrated in certain neighborhoods, not that it's all, it's not going down in those neighborhoods.
Absolutely. It's actually going up in the hotspot neighborhoods, but down overall in the city. And the reason that, you know, so, you know, the local the government and its entities will always try to celebrate bringing down crime and violence. But when you think about crime and violence in Chicago, it's really never been a Chicago problem. It's, you know, we got about five or six hotspot areas in Chicago. Those neighborhoods in general have depopulated overall. The population of people living in those neighborhoods has gone down drastically. But the violence in the neighborhood has spiked. And that is something that, you know, we need to pay attention to. But it's hard to tell because most people talk about violence overall in Chicago, like the rate of violence in Chicago. But that is not a good way to look at it. You want to look at what's happening in the hotspot neighborhoods.
Interesting. I had a texter who asked your guests, if Larry Hoover could be a CEO of a major corporation, is he a smart guy? Is he an organized guy? Is he a person who could actually succeed had he just applied himself in an appropriate way?
Yeah, I think he's a very shrewd guy, very just like many CEOs of our corporations. Doesn't necessarily have to be academically smart, but a very charismatic person, a great people person. People are very loyal to him. So in that way, yes, he could have been, like I always say, you know, as a kid, he grew up in the area that I mentioned to you. He grew up seeing drug dealers and pimps and prostitutes. I think if you would have put him in the same situation where he saw corporate leaders and academics, he would have been one of them. Because he was very smart and he picked up and learned a lot from people that were in his immediate environment.
Interesting. Can you stay with us another segment? I've got some more questions for you, Dr.
Sure.
Williams. Okay, great.
Sure.
And we're talking about the commutation of the sentence of Larry Hoover. Do we know, Dr. Williams, if he's out of Florence yet? Do we know anything about that?
I don't know. I don't know. I've heard different things. I've heard he's still there. I've heard he's in the state. So yeah, I don't know. I'm not sure.
So he, you know, and he was serving a term in Illinois, and the question is Illinois going to keep him or is Illinois going to release him? And I don't know. Again, this is political in nature, I suppose, but this would have to be some sort of pardon or commutation by our governor here, who now has the authority to do that. If he chooses, what are the considerations here from a political standpoint, and what do you predict is going to happen?
Yeah, well, it's hard to predict what's going to happen. I know this situation probably puts the governor in a very difficult situation for several political reasons. One, elected officials never want to be perceived as being soft on crime. And so to pardon him or to allow him to have completed his sentence early, so to speak. That would be pressure for him politically. But then on the flip side of it, Mr. Hoover is a very popular person within the African-American community, and particularly those who are activists in spirit. And, I don't think the governor would want to be on the wrong side of them as well. So he's in a tough situation. What he'll do, I'm not sure. I just don't know. I'm not sure how he's going to, handle this situation.
You know, you have talked a little bit on our show about how you believe that some of the violence that we see in the city, and you touched on it today, is not necessarily gang related in that territorial wars and those types of things. And rather, the violence is as a result of certain interpersonal disputes. Can you tell our listeners about this? I mean, you have your boots on the ground on these things. So you know, and you talk to these individuals and the community leaders, and you know what these disputes are about.
Yes. So, unfortunately, most of the violence that we see today, particularly gun violence in black and brown communities, where, I think young African-American males are the perpetrators and victims of gun violence, at the percentage of over 80%. And when you look at these incidences of shootings, almost all of them are a result of an interpersonal conflict between two individuals who had whatever beef and settled it, through violence. Very little of it has to do with the kind of violence we saw back in the day where the GDs or the Stones or Vice Lords were more organized, when those groups may have been involved in violence based on territory, drug territory, and you would get, shootings that would occur to take over a territory or to defend a territory. Since those organizations have basically fallen apart, now it's just an issue of interpersonal beef, where GDs are more likely to kill each other than they are those who are considered their adversaries or opposition.
One of the things that you talk about, Dr. Williams, which I find fascinating, is the issue of why the African-American community has these issues. And you talk a little bit about toxic masculinity and how it's different in some of these underprivileged communities versus the other communities. Can you try to explain that to my listeners?
Yeah, so very clearly to me in my research and my lived experience from almost childhood and watching the ebbs and flows of violence, particularly in the most marginalized black communities, is an issue of young African-American males in particular having a misguided and distorted sense of manhood, and also having a role strain in terms of when you are as a young male, a young African American male, when you have been displaced from all other forms of ways to make money legitimately, to have a decent education, to have the kind of things that men should have in society, be able to take care of yourself and take care of your family, it causes a lot of stress and anxiety around not being able to do that. And so what happens ultimately is this whole idea of manhood it takes on this physical manifestation where I might not be able to provide for myself and my family. I may still live in a basement at my grandmother's house, and I may not have an education. But what I can do is I can protect and defend my body. And the way that I exert my manhood is by doing that and also controlling and imposing myself on other men like me. And what that does is that leads to a toxic environment where some small thing like looking at someone, giving them eye contact too long, or being rude or disrespectful, calling someone out of their name, can escalate into a shooting very quickly. And it's about just having a poor sense of identity, being very insecure in yourself and your manhood, and you feel like you need to defend yourself at all costs, because if you're considered weak and less than a man, then everybody's going to take advantage of you. So it just triggers a lot of violence. And until we get to solving that problem, we're not going to ever reduce the high levels of gun violence in these communities.
You know, you're so right, because sometimes you now read why, you know, what was the motive for the shooting, as if there's ever a good motive to shoot somebody. But, you know, a lot of times it's a rap lyric or it's something like that, and a sign of disrespect. And you think of how silly that is, but you have to put it in the context that you just put it in, that this is as a result of not being able to feel secure. You know, we're not making excuses, but we're giving an explanation.
That's right.
So you know, you would like to see the crime rates go down in these communities. You've worked with community leaders, you worked with individuals. What needs to happen? I mean, that's a question that could be could fill five different books. But in a short period of time, can you explain to our listeners what you think the solutions are here?
Yeah, I think the solutions exist on three levels. You know, obviously, what we need now is we need a kind of a triage approach. We need to in the short term, we need boots on the ground. We need funding for individuals who are not just volunteers, but individuals that are paid to go out and do street outreach in the community, to who speak the language of those that are the most likely to be perpetrators of violence and victims of violence, individuals who have the lived experience that can go into these neighborhoods and to these areas and connect with the guys and try to mediate any kind of conflict that's going. That's short term, right? And then in the long term, ultimately in the long term, we're going to need to fix the institutions in these neighborhoods. Like, the schools are just totally dysfunctional, right? There is no real prospects for, you know, living wage jobs. Like, in the long term, you're going to have to fix those things. You're going to have to rebuild those institutions. It's a severe housing crisis. So a lot of these guys that are involved with, you know, shootings and this, you know, a lot of them are essentially homeless. You know, they're place to place and not, you know, so we have to fix the housing crisis, the education crisis, the economic crisis. Those are long-term things. But in the short term, you need boots on the ground, individuals who get paid to go out and mediate conflict, to be present, to keep the spaces safe, because a lot of this has to do with young men feeling unsafe. So they feel like they need to carry a gun with them everywhere they go, and it's easy access to high-powered weaponry. So just imagine an environment, a 2 or 3 block radius, where you have, you know, 10 to 20 guys that are all armed with high-powered weapons, who don't have a job, who are, you know, The only thing they have access to are guns and drugs and alcohol.
A bad combination, all in all. Yeah.
Yes. Yeah.
So, you know, you talk about, I think you have said this, that the violent crime costs the city over $2.5 billion a year. I think you said that somewhere.
At least, minimally.
And when you look at that number, you know, what comprises that number?
The number is comprised of law enforcement services that go to investigate and to address issues of after shooting, health care, what it costs to, you know, once an individual is shot. I think on average, the average shooting victim is going to incur about $1 million in health care services at a ER, right? And a homicide. No, I think a homicide is $1 million, and in a shooting can be as much as $1.5 million just for a non-fatal shooting, right? So the healthcare costs, you're looking at the loss of business and revenue in areas where people are afraid to open businesses because it's too violent. Right. And so when you add up all of those costs, but primarily law enforcement, primarily health care, it's going to be minimally about $2.5 billion to $5 billion annually. Because someone has to eat that cost. Right. Like these guys don't have, you know, health insurance. So someone's got to pay for that. And it's the city.
And so I guess when you think about throwing money at a problem, you know, that you need to at least consider that it might be worth it to do just that, to not only save money, but also to make our city more livable for everyone. But I really appreciate you coming on, Dr. Lance Williams. He is the author of several books. You can look him up, Culture and Perceptions of Violence, Related Behaviors Among Adolescents. He's a professor at Northeastern Illinois University. Thanks for joining us, and you have yourself a good summer.
Thanks so much for having me.